Welcome back to the Drive and Kick SB Nation NBA podcast.
Many teams use the drive and kick as a staple of their offense.
Drive! Kicks out.
Drives. Kick out.
It requires a team with effective dribblers.
Quick crossover and a drive.
Passers.
What a pass!
And shooters.
Quick release three-pointer. That's good.
I'm your host, Paul Flannery.
Let's see how it's done.
Let's get into this, because okay. I have you on today because, one, I've long admired your work covering the Los Angeles Clippers, and good friend to me last year when I was out there in L.A. when things were oddly like kumbaya around the Clippers at that point. And
yes,
Dan, I don't know what to make of this team right now. Like, they're clearly good and talented, but help me out here. What is going on with this team? Because they don't make sense to me right now.
I think, and I think that's kind of like the, that would be sort of the slogan this year is, they don't make sense to me right now. For me, too. And I've watched them play a lot of basketball. I'm just not 100% sure how good I think they are. You know, they're a team that can go to Portland and be pretty dominant. They're a team that can look like they've got no idea what to do against an elite contender. They've, you know, almost won in Atlanta on the end of maybe the worst 4-5 that I've seen, and or certainly that I've been a part of, and they almost win that game on the road. But then when they catch the Hawks at home, they look completely overwhelmed. They're just very up and down. I think if you were going to look to pinpoint an easy kind of one place where they for sure need to get better, I would say their bench isn't as good as it was a year ago. Certainly not as good as it was 2 years ago. But even that seems like a little bit of a cop-out. It seems like it's, like, weirder than that.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. Because, I mean, you have two of the – I don't know. Can we call Chris Paul and Blake Griffin two of the top 15 players in the league and
sure.
Not let people yell at us?
Well, I can't guarantee that. But, yeah, I think that's right.
Okay, sure. You know, and last year I thought Blake was a top 5 player. And, like, I don't see – that much slippage in him. We'll get into him a little bit more, but clearly you've got two terrific players. You've got DeAndre Jordan, you've got JJ Redick, you've got Jamal Crawford. We know the issues on the wing, but that's a really good starting five, and to me, that's got to be where we start here, right?
It is a really good starting five, and kind of the numbers bear that out too. Like the five-man lineup data for the starters, they're as good as anybody in the NBA. You know, one of the sneaky things that, you know, we talk about their issues on the wing, and they exist for sure. But one of the reasons why they haven't been that big of a deal this year is Matt Barnes is shooting 48%. You know, he's shooting 39.5% from three. He's having one of his best shooting seasons of his career at 34 years old after, honestly, Paul, having the worst, like, it looked like he needed an exorcism in the preseason. Like, it was so bad. Like, this is a guy who shot under 10%.
Right.
Field in the preseason. All of a sudden, you know, he starts playing well for them. JJ Redick having a terrific year. You know, Chris Paul shooting near 40% from three, which is, you know, an uptick for him after, you know, years of negative trending in that area. That group is good. I think that group is really good. It just gets a little complicated when you start looking. I mean, they've been really healthy. You know, Matt Barnes has missed two games, and everybody else has been healthy. You know, and so you look at it, and you start scratching your head, and you're like, well, why aren't they better?
Right. Right. And, I mean, you know, we're talking about a team that, as we're recording this, I believe is 28-14. I mean, that's a really good team. Now, the West is the West is the West, but, you
sure.
know, and, you know, their offensive rating is like, at the top of the league. Their defense seems to have slipped this year.
Yeah, it's not as good. You know, they were kind of, I felt like their numbers last year were a little inflated. They were a team that tended to defend really well against the Orlando Magics of the world, you know, and they would seem to have these kind of dominant defensive games against not great teams. And then, you know, and that led to a top 10 defensive rating. They were probably more like, I mean, this is not a real metric, just kind of my eye test. They were probably, like, I'd say slightly above average defensively last year on a consistent basis. This year they're slightly below average. Again, I think part of that kind of falls on the bench. I think that they don't have that group doesn't have like a real kind of like go get after a defender. Mm-hmm. Oddly enough, that's kind of what they hope they're going to get out of Austin Rivers.
Hmm.
But yeah, that's a noise I've heard. So I think that's kind of one of those things where that's maybe where the defensive rating has slipped a little bit. It's weird too. You would expect of them, and I don't know. I don't know what your kind of preseason expectations were for them, but I feel like an idiot because I spent a week in preseason writing about how good their continuity was going to be.
Right.
You know, and then you watch them on the court the first time, and it looked like it was five guys who just met each other.
Yeah, it's very strange. By the way, I think we should introduce Danalytics to the conversation. Yeah, they don't look that great to me. So I'm going to say they should be better. So, all right, Austin Rivers, you bring this up.
Yes.
Okay, I can't find a lot of people, and this is a tough one for me because people who have followed me over the years know that I have strong feelings for Doc, and I've liked Austin too, but I haven't found anyone who thinks this is a good idea.
Yeah, I get that. I'll tell you this: I don't think it's a disaster idea.
Mm-hmm.
So we can add that to my analytical analysis. I don't think this is the worst. Like, there was a feeling when he made this trade, like, oh my God, what's he doing? This is, you know, season suicide. There's no way they can do this. It's all over. Right, and to those people, I would submit the fact that this was a team that, as currently constructed, was going nowhere anyways. And I think what they did, they did two things. I think part of it was change for change's sake. I think that the group they had put together wasn't working. It was clear that it wasn't working. I think Jordan Farmar was not the player they wanted. And I don't think Doc was the coach Jordan thought he was getting. I think there was a different role that Jordan thought he was going to have. There was somewhere in that kind of recruiting process or whatever, wires got crossed. And it was a bad fit. It was like, you know, it was just one of those relationships where it's like, you know, your significant other isn't like a bad person. It just doesn't fit.
Yeah.
And that's kind of, you know, and it can get kind of when it doesn't fit like that, but you're stuck together, it can get awkward. And I think that's kind of where they were at on that. You know, they were left. Look, I mean, the easy way to pick apart kind of their offseason was is essentially they chose Spencer Hawes over Paul Pierce. And that looks like a mistake at this point, too.
I thought it looked like a mistake last summer.
See, you were in the minority there. Like, that was something that a lot of people thought, oh, my gosh, Spencer Hawes, this is the floor spacer they need. He can make free throws when DeAndre Jordan's getting intentionally fouled. You know, he at least tries to be a rim protector. He hasn't fit. Like, and again, I think you can make excuses for it. I think it's hard. And you cover this league. When you're a guy who's used to playing 30 minutes a game and all of a sudden you're playing half that, it's hard to find your way.
No, sure, absolutely.
And I think he hasn't found it yet. I just think, like, when I watch him play, he's a guy that I look at and I say, why doesn't he shoot more? But then when you watch him shoot, you're like, why is he shooting? And I think it's because he doesn't look – he's not confident right now. You know, career lows and, you know, three – I mean, it's just it's all. Like, the minutes are down. The scoring is down. He's not nearly as aggressive. It's – That's a weird thing. Sorry, we sidetracked off of Austin Rivers.
No. All this is connected as far as I'm concerned.
So they bring in Austin Rivers. And I think people first of all thinking that Austin Rivers was brought in as the guy to fix the bench have completely misinterpreted this trade. Because that's not it. I mean, what they were able to do essentially and what they did in this move is they were able to flip two contracts for one player, and then they were able to get additional flexibility by waiving Jordan Farmar. Mm-hmm. So now what they can do now that, like, Doc loves the buyout market, because he has to, because he doesn't have the assets to be involved in really in the trade market. So, you know, this is how they can get better is, you know, what happens if Brooklyn decides that, you know, we don't want to pay Kevin Garnett anymore. You know what I mean? Now mm-hmm. the Clippers have the flexibility to be in that conversation.
I have a hard time seeing that happening.
You do?
Oh, yeah. I really do. Doc, you know, Kevin and Doc love each other, and that's one of the great relationships I've ever been around in this league. But, like, Kevin hates change. I can't emphasize this enough. He
and doing
despises,
in the middle of the season.
Oh
too,
my god!
Would be going, a nightmare. Yeah.
Going cross country.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, I'm just saying, like for instance, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? Like in a for instance, kind of like that. I think it's something where, you know, they're in those conversations. Maybe they like Tayshaun Prince. If Tayshaun Prince gets bought out, maybe that, you know, whoever it is, and you know, they were able to add Glenn Davis and Danny Granger last year to varying results. And I think, you know, they liked enough what they saw to Big Baby to bring him back. I don't know. I think that's just how they're going to have to get better. And it's they can't make big changes because, honestly, if they start – you start talking about them making big changes and, like, a lot of my readers, people follow me on Twitter, you know, wanted them to trade for Jeff Green. Mm-hmm. You know, and I reported that one of the early asking prices for Jeff Green was, you know, Matt Barnes, Jamal Crawford in a first. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's like, okay, well, if that first would be a 2019 first, so you've traded away your first round picks in the odd numbered years for the next 3 years. You're giving, you know, away all your bench scoring, and you know, a guy who would be your wing depth too for another small forward who would be an upgrade, but. You've created another hole kind of in your boat by plugging one.
And this seems to be a pattern here with Doc running the basketball side of things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you do, you create one thing at the expense of another, which is, you know, generally how things work, but
sure.
It seems to me ever since he took over that it's been like the move for today without thinking too much about a year or two down the line. And that's, that is always the issue when you have coaches doing this kind of thing because they're only thinking about today. That's all they're thinking about.
He's wired to win, right? And I don't know that that's even the wrong way to approach it when you've got a team with Chris Paul, you know what I mean, and you know about his injury history and stuff like that. But they've also got young assets too, so you want to be able to make sure that 4 years from now that Blake Griffin's surrounded by a good team too. They're in a little bit of a precarious situation. You know, I think they're going to have to make a huge decision. It's going to be a fascinating decision this summer with what to do with DeAndre Jordan.
And they have to sign him. They have to.
I think they're stuck. And it's because they don't – it's not like they could, you know, say, well, we're not going to sign DeAndre Jordan, and then now we're far enough under the cap where we can go convince Marc Gasol to come play here.
Right.
Like that's not an option for them. So I think they've got to re-sign him. And when you do, and when you pay him what kind of the value that Doc's created for him by talking about him like he's Bill Russell, you know, now all of a sudden you're doubling down on a core of guys that have gone, you know, we'll see what happens this postseason, but, you know, maybe haven't gotten to the conference finals.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is my issue with it. It's if you reach a ceiling that is second round conference finals, that's a pretty good ceiling. But if that's the ceiling, there's really nowhere to go. You're boxed in here.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that's another thing why people were so worked up about the Austin Rivers trade is that, and I was one of these people that kind of championed this idea a little bit, was that one way that they could really get better was if they had hit on Reggie Bullock.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if he was a guy that was going to be a 3-and-D type player, who they could run out there in their starting lineup, that was how they could upgrade, you know, and he was kind of the cost for flexibility. I don't feel like they wanted to necessarily trade him. He was really only one of two young assets that they had that were movable. But I'm not 100% convinced either, though, that it was, like, again, that the cost of change now, this is exactly what you're talking about. For them to get better now, they had to do it, and they had to sacrifice kind of another piece of their future. I don't know that that's the wrong thing to do, but it's certainly they've kind of laid the groundwork. This is their strategy, you know. They want to win now, and when you look around the West and you look at what these other teams have been able to add and how teams have gotten better, you know, when I look at the Clippers, and I see this a little bit with the Thunder too. Granted, they just added Deion Waiters, but like these are teams that they didn't make any big moves. They kind of relied upon themselves to get better. Thunder obviously had the injury problems. Clippers just, you know, they're kind of small. They're small additions. You know, Spencer Hawes, obviously Jordan Farmar. Those just didn't work out.
Yeah. And, like, you know, and to go back to Spencer for a second, like, I get everything you were saying made total sense. That's what they needed. They needed a floor-spacing big man, you know, someone who would at least, you know, make an effort to protect the paint on defense as, you know, anchoring that second team.
Sure.
All that kind of stuff. Everything you're saying makes sense. Paul Pierce is still a better player.
Yep.
And that, and to me, when he went to Washington, I was like, oh, man, this is perfect. Because I don't know if that would have the same dynamic in L.A. just because Chris and Blake, you know, and DeAndre have been through this a little bit. But for a team like Washington, getting Paul Pierce, who thinks he's going to win every game he plays, is perfect.
You know,
he just is that kind of guy. And so that would have been an interesting dynamic, especially given his relationship with Doc and how strong that is, how that would have played with everyone. So, I mean, like, I get it. I totally get it. At the end of the day, I keep coming back to the point that Paul Pierce is just a better player. And if you have $6 million, just get the best player.
Yeah, I mean, I think they probably tried to get a little too cute, and they tried to get both, you know, and they thought that maybe they could get Paul at the biannual, or, you know what I mean? And it turns out that Paul Pierce still likes money to a degree, and he likes a good situation, too, when all things are equal. Something like that's going to matter.
Sure.
I mean, really quickly, too, to touch back on Austin, there is one thing out there, though, that I think is a real concern about this. And when you talk about kind of like locker room dynamics, is what's going to happen, and you're running enough locker rooms, I'm curious about this, too. What's going to happen when there's a game where, you know, Doc does something that is not agreed upon by the kind of the locker room leaders. And after a game, kind of in that blow off period where guys want to kind of curse out the coach, where guys want to kind of vent. What happens when you look down three lockers and you see the coach's son?
It's hard.
Yeah. Does that change what people say? Now, I would think that everybody involved is going to be so much on eggshells about this, that you could kind of make the kind of the logical jump that you can say anything around Austin Rivers because he's so worried about, you know, his reputation, and he's so worried about being in the league next year that he can't say anything. So, you know, let it rip, and he'll be a teammate first and the coach's son second. But that seems like a pretty big leap to make for someone you just met.
Yeah, I think that's exactly what he would try to do. I think you're right. But, yeah, I mean, you know, it gets into a very tricky thing. I mean, I've never been in a situation where I played for my father since, like, you know, fifth grade Little League baseball, I guess. I don't even remember, you know. It was fun. but
I tweeted a picture, Paul, real quickly, of I think it was something along the lines of, like, playing for your dad can be hard. Here I am pictured in the back left corner, and it's a picture of my dad, like our team picture from fourth grade basketball. My dad is just kneeling, and his head is directly in front of mine, just blocking my fist.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's strange. I mean, like, all right, not to get too ridiculous about this, but, you know, I remember, like, growing up, you know, the kid's father was the coach, and that kid always made the all-star team, even though he wasn't that good, and he was always the pitcher, and always sucked. And, like, you know, I think it just leads to these teams are fragile, and not fragile, I don't want to use that word because that gets misconstrued, but what you have is a very delicate balancing act of personalities, and, you know, all this kind of, like, I just spent some time with the Hawks, and, like,
yeah,
my God, are those guys connected. And
yep, makes a lot of sense.
It does. And of course they're playing well, so that makes it easier, but, like, you know, I was talking to Korver about this, and he knows, he was like, this may not happen again, like, we better take advantage of this right now to get that thing where everybody's on the same page and nobody is miserable or complaining or this, that, or the other. That is very, very, very rare. And so I've heard lots of weird things about chemistry issues with this team. Was that directly related to the guys who left? Like, what's happening here?
Okay, so I tried to write about this earlier, earlier this week, and I think you know, the guy who I went to and who kind of opened my eyes most about it was JJ Redick, and talking to JJ about what chemistry actually even is, you know, and kind of the analogy I landed on was, like, it's sort of like a shellfish. Like, if you have a shellfish, right, and you eat shrimp, and shrimp screws you up bad, you know, and shrimp doesn't work for your body. That doesn't mean all shrimp is evil or all shrimp, you know, to be taken off the market, and it doesn't work for someone else. It just doesn't fit for you. And I think that's kind of when you're putting together kind of the ingredient list of a team, like there are certain things you need and there are certain things the Clippers didn't have. One of the things that I noticed in Sacramento, and this could be just because of, you know, from a media seating standpoint in Sacramento, you're right in the corner on the floor directly behind the Clipper bench is where I was sitting. So I mean, I had no choice but to notice. It was like you notice a guy like Dante Jones, you know, who bounces up out of his chair after every basket. And what that does is on a team, especially on the road, on the second night of a back-to-back, is that that creates a little bit of an energy. And then that kind of rubs off. So now when J.J. Redick shoots a corner three, now Dante Jones and Austin Rivers are standing up. You know, and then next it's Epe Udo and then Glenn Davis. And then when the bench goes in and Glenn Davis gets a bucket, now all of a sudden, you know, Blake Griffin's standing up. And DeAndre Jordan standing up, and now it kind of steamrolls from there, where now you've got this kind of energy. Now, that's not to say that Jordan Farmar was a bad guy because he didn't provide this. It was just not in his personality. Redick is hilarious. He's like, it's not in my personality. I'm literally laying down on the court when I'm not in.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, it's not who I am either. But, you know, chemistry is so delicate. That's I'll use delicate for that. It literally is like chemistry, where it just if one little thing is off, it can kind of make it all crumble. Now, does this result in wins? I don't know that matters. You know, I think look ultimately, I think the fact that Austin Rivers went out in that Sacramento game and tortured Ray McCallum and tortured Darren Collison when he got the chance and just played with such defensive intensity. Like, it gave him a spark. They haven't had that. But that's not who Jordan Farmar was, and that's not Jordan Farmar's fault.
Right. No, and that makes sense. And, you know, by the way, Sacramento, I love the seating arrangement there. I was only out there once, and it was for a Celtics-Kings game during the lockout season when, like, you never knew what you were going to get from the Celtics at that point. Like, every other game, they could win by 30 or lose by 30. And this was, you know, another back-to-back, like a 5-7, and they were playing the Kings and just getting crushed. And KG and DeMarcus were just going at each other. I heard words, Dan, I have never heard before.
one of my favorite – so it used to be – was this when it was courtside, right?
Yes.
Okay, so I remember one of my favorite things was there was a player – and I didn't hear it, so I won't say his name. Sure. But there was a player who apparently said something derogatory to a fan, a Clipper player, in a game against the Kings. This is 3 years ago. And at which point, DeMarcus Cousins, this is during a game, by the way, DeMarcus Cousins beelines over to the press row and says, "Did you hear what he just said? If I said that, you'd all write it."
That's awesome. And like, I missed that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's you don't get that when you're sitting, you know, 40 rows away.
No, I don't want to go down this road too far, but I mean, I do miss the intimacy of where people used to be and in this league because there's so much happening on the court that's just fascinating when you're up close. But anyway, we shouldn't digress.
No. It's still fun to be there whenever if you're 50 rows, if you're 100 rows away, it's still fun.
Of course. Absolutely. All right, let's talk about Blake a little bit.
Yep.
Because, you know, Blake, to me, last year was one of the breakout players of the season. I mean, he went from being an all-star to a legit MVP candidate. And, you know, I don't think he's fallen off that much, but I don't think that he's certainly not in that MVP discussion, like that top five player discussion. So what's up with him this year?
I mean, I think he's become a little bit more of a facilitator, which, you know, he's averaging an assist more per game, which doesn't seem like a lot. He's passing more. I think that's part of it. I think he hasn't 100% found the balance between kind of this improved jump shot and kind of the kind of get me the ball on the block, I'm just going to go beat you up type of thing either. He's not, you know, he's shooting far less from inside. And he's finishing at a worse percentage too in the post, whereas, you know, when you put him at 16 feet, you know, now he's a 40% shooter. You know, he's become a good jump shooter. And that shot's almost always there. He's always been kind of a guy, Paul, who's like, he prides himself in taking what's available. And I think there was elements of that. I think another thing with him this year was that in talking to him, he's been very big picture. Maybe that's you know, multiple trips to the playoffs where he's been injured.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where, you know, putting another player on a poster becomes less of a priority when you're getting, and he gets hammered during games. Like, he gets fouled, and he dishes out a lot of punishment too, but he definitely takes hard fouls. I wonder if some of this is kind of self-preservation too, which is a weird thing for a 25-year-old.
Yeah, but in this league, we're talking, what, like 4 or 5 years into his career now, and as you say, mm-hmm. that's a lot of minutes, that's a lot of pounding, and he gives it as well as he receives. I mean,
like, for sure, 100%.
You know, he's one of the more physical players in the league, which people don't really appreciate about him. But, yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating thing when a player realizes, okay, I can't go 100 miles an hour all the time anymore. How am I going to dial this back and still be effective?
And I think he's trying to figure that out still. I still think there's a balance there. I mean, you know, I think, like, all you need to know about that is, like, he's shooting a free throw and a half less per game this year.
Right.
You know, and that was one area where he made a big jump. I mean, he's still scoring. I mean, he's averaging 23 points a game. And so much of that is because he goes to the free throw and he thinks he's going to make them all. You know, like, that's where he's at. From a confidence standpoint at the free throw line, it's been an incredible transformation 4 years ago when he was just, it was a coin flip. And you'll see, I mean, that's resulted in those extra points every game. I just, you know, like, kind of like everybody else, like, I remember early in the year, people would ask me if he was hurt because he wasn't dunking enough, you know? And I remember I asked Doc one question when he looked at me like it was the worst question he'd ever heard. But it was kind of like he didn't necessarily look 100% right. But I think a lot of that, like I said, was just kind of preservation. He hasn't had a very good defensive season. Not the way that they kind of hoped.
Right.
I mean, after Doc saw what building up kind of the DeAndre Jordan defensive case and seeing the impact he can make on that team, he tried that with Blake, albeit not as kind of with not the same zeal. But I remember earlier this year, he said that he thought Blake could be an all-defense team caliber defender. And I haven't seen that yet.
Right. And that's hard. It's hard when you're the 1A guy offensively to also be the 1A guy on defense. I mean, like, there's a reason why LeBron is an all-time great in that regard. And you see this year, he hasn't really been putting out as much.
I was just going to say, yeah. I mean, I think it's a great thing. I mean, I think, you know, people – and this carries over to Chris Paul too, is when people, because he has to be a guy, just with the way the league's made up right now, that has to be an all-out defensive guy, because almost every night you're playing a great point guard, and so people sometimes look at him and say, oh, why doesn't he, like, I mean, Doc says this, why doesn't he shoot more? Why isn't he more aggressive? And I think a big part of that is because he's chasing around Damian Lillard or Steph Curry or, you know, whoever, Jeff Teague. It just doesn't stop.
No, it doesn't. And that's actually a good intro into Chris Paul, because yet again, here he is. Like, I feel like there's always like one or two points in the season when everyone stops to appreciate what he's doing. But for the most part, he just kind of keeps going about his Chris Paul business, you know, being the best point guard in the NBA in an era where there are so many good point guards. And, you know, it's our friend Zach Lowe wrote about this early in the season, talking about legacies and all that kind of stuff, and how use the Chris Paul example as a guy who has not achieved that kind of postseason success. I totally agree with everything Zach said. That said, like, at some point, we got to see Chris have a deep playoff run, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think how different is it if instead of, you know, I mean, if obviously this is a crazy what if, but, you know, they were essentially one good possession, one good offensive possession away from heading to LA up 3-2 over the Oklahoma City Thunder.
Mm-hmm.
It's all it would have taken. And that entire total breakdown in game five would have been one good offensive possession. And they didn't have it. And they lost. And I think after kind of everything that they had gone through during that season, they couldn't have an ounce of any more adversity, kind of crumbled in game six, never got it going, you know, season's over. But they were, like, without Serge Ibaka in the series, like, I they were the better team, you know, and we're close to making conference finals. Do we view him differently if he goes and loses in the conference finals to the Spurs, which I think they would have? You know, I don't know. And then at a certain point, if he makes the finals, do we view him differently if he doesn't win?
Right. Right.
It's hard. Legacy's tricky. I mean, I think, look, he is, if not the best point guard in the NBA right now, at age 29, you know, age 30, he's one of the best. And he's changed the position for a lot of players. He's kind of a really an interesting kind of new school example. You know, you see, like, you know, Doc was not the guy who was super chummy, even though he's incredibly friendly with other players around the league when he was coming up. It's not what the league was.
Right.
It was, you know, genuine, I don't want to say animosity, but if we're on the other team, we weren't that close, probably, unless we grew up together or something. I mean, Chris knows everybody in the NBA. He's the play. I mean, not just because he's like the union president, but like this is a guy who has like a point guard elite camp every year. So if you're one of the 10 best college point guards, you know, he's going to work with you in the summer. Now, part of my kind of cynicism, think that's just to kind of put together a dossier on how to torture these guys later, you know, and start to kind of build a scouting report. But, you know, I mean, whether it's anybody from Steph Curry, you know, talking about how before his rookie year, how he used to work out with Chris and, you know, essentially almost lived with him for, you know, a summer, to Isaiah Cannon talking about it. If you're a player in the NBA, you've worked out with him probably. And it's weird. He's an interesting kind of new school guy like that.
When I was out there, I was struck by how he is able to keep everyone kind of at bay. Press, everyone, you know. Have you, in the years you've been covering, have you been able to make a deeper connection with him over the years? Or is he still someone who just kind of is a bit of an enigma from a media standpoint?
It's better than it was. Like, he's somebody that I would have thought 2 years ago just didn't really know who I was, mm-hmm. even though I was around every day. It was just kind of the feeling that I got from him. He wasn't that interested. Like, I didn't really know that much stuff about him or his family or, you know, what his other interests were. You know, sometimes in locker rooms there are guys you have non-basketball related questions with and you talk to them about other things and you connect with them that way. With Chris, I never really had that. And I'm not saying that we're tight now. And boy, he loves talking to me about the Dallas Cowboys or anything like that. But it's better. Like, you know, I think, I mean, he's gotten a little more comfortable. But you're right. I mean, he's very, very polished with the media, calculating and knows what he's saying and knows what he's doing. And I think that's by design. I just think that, you know, he lets a lot of blend. And moments I've caught him at times, like I wrote something earlier this year on the anniversary of his grandfather's murder, where he was great. I mean, talking about it and talking about kind of what his pregame routine is and how when he prays, he lists by name like every member in his family.
Hmm.
You know, and the last name always is his grandpa. And you know, it was like a personal, like emotional conversation. And I don't know that I would have had that with him, or I would have felt comfortable to have that with him 2 or 3 years ago. But, you know, when you're around every day and you're on the road and stuff like this, you know, I think you just eventually you wear them down and they figure out who you are. they've just got no choice but to talk to you.
It's such a transient league, too. I mean, you're in a situation kind of like what I was a few years ago. I mean, like the Celtics core never changed. So mm-hmm. after a while, you get to know Ray and Paul and, well, Kevin as much as you could and Rondo and those guys. But
sure.
Like, you know, and then I started noticing in the last year or two, I'm like, all those guys are gone, and I don't know these new guys at all. And I'm not around as much anymore because I'm not on the beat anymore. But when you actually have years, you know, to a relationship, it does start to take on a more personal quality because you're just around all the time.
No, exactly. And I mean, it's something that, like, you know, whereas 2 years ago, there was a good example would have been like a couple weeks ago or a week or so ago, DeAndre Jordan tweeted something after they traded, Farmar, and he tweeted something along the lines of like, wow, you know, can't believe they're gone. It was worded in a way where it sounded like he was the one who got traded.
Yes. I remember that.
Okay. And he deleted it 10 minutes later and then an hour later put something back up. Now, you know, if you don't know him, that's like, you can have a conversation about it and have it be like, oh yeah, I just worded it wrong or whatever. But because I know him and I know kind of his personality, the conversation I had with him about that was, you know, there's no way Blake will ever hire you to write Players Tribune now. and you know, and then he fired back. He's like, you guys forget I was only in college for like 4 weeks. And you know, stuff like that. Like, it's, you can have those kinds of exchanges, or if you need to get to something deeper, like, you know, a trust between writer and athlete, like the Reddick conversation that I mentioned earlier when he talks about chemistry. Now, that's something where I think I could have pulled stuff out of context in that and made it look totally different, but he knows that, he trusts that I know that team, you know, too, and that I'm familiar with what they're going through as well, so he kind of trusts me with his words on a delicate subject.
Right.
And that's where those relationships, I think, really matter.
Right. No, it's a fun team to be around, and you've got some good personalities. But one guy we haven't talked about yet is Steve Ballmer. Right?
Right.
How have things changed? Has there been notable change with him?
I mean, they have an owner that I talk to periodically, which is not what the case was before. I've had more conversations, you know, in 3 months with Steve Ballmer than I had in 3 years with Donald Sterling, which is, you know, totally fine. I think, you know, you see that they've invested kind of in their infrastructure more. You get a new owner, especially a really rich one, and it's not like they don't own their stadium either. So it's people, I think, want to see, like, crazy tangible proof that they're spending money. You know, like, whether, and I think people thought that they could just go out, they sign whoever they wanted, you know, casual fans or whatever. And it's just not how it works. And you can only do it certain ways. Now, I think that, you know, they've got high paid assistants. I think that's one way an owner can make an impact. I think they've got, you know, they've done things like they added like the 3D kind of court player intros that, like, you know, Atlanta has that look great. They do stuff like that now. They've got Fergie performing at Ames, which I'm sure she isn't volunteering.
Yes.
You know, I mean, like, stuff like that. Those are tangible changes. I think they remodeled the family room at State Center. Just little things. You know, will they ever do the locker room? That's something they could maybe do. It's just they're a little limited. You worry less about, and this is going to sound weird considering how he dances, but you don't worry about him embarrassing you as much.
Hmm.
Which was always kind of a fear, I think, with Donald Sterling, was that he was going to do or say something that he did that was going to make life really uncomfortable for everybody.
Right. I mean, that's. I remember when I was out there last year just seeing Donald sitting courtside, I was like, oy.
Yeah, it's weird. It's not a pleasant experience, right? I mean, he's. You know, he's sitting back, like, just don't know. Like, he could explode a player like Baron Davis. Now, I mean, what happened was surreal things ever and be around. I mean, for me, like, I know I've never been around anything quite like that. But, you know, I was on court, and you alternate between feeling like this person's a total mobster, to this person's totally ill, to some combination of both. And it was just really uncomfortable. I think that, you know, at least with Ballmer, they've been able to move beyond that. And when, you know, something like him dancing to Fergie comes up, you know, players are able to kind of joke about that. They know Steve. He wants to call Steve, which is just a change. He's a very regular guy for somebody who has $20 billion.
He's a regular guy for somebody with $20 billion. That's a great line. And Dan, I'm going to get you out of here on that because this has been very insightful.
I'm gonna go out on a high note. That's good. I like.
I know. You gotta go off on the high note. On the walk off, you gotta go off on the walk off. Dan Wyke, Orange County Register. Every once in a while, I can actually read your stories online.
They're free now.
Are they free now?
Yeah. Well, welcome to a shift in strategy.
Talk about burying the lead. That's fantastic. Everybody go out and read Dan. He's great.
Click away.
Click away. All right, Dan. Great stuff. Thanks a lot, buddy. And hopefully, I will see you down the road. Actually,
We don't get to Boston until late. You going to be at the All-Star game, Paul?
I will be at the All-Star game. Actually, a little spoiler for people. Will you be in New Orleans next week?
I will be.
Well, then I'll see you there.
Okay, awesome. We'll have to go to Koshan Butcher, one of my favorite road sandwich spots.
It's delicious. I don't think that there's a second place on that one. I mean, we basically ate every meal there during the All-Star game last year.
Oh, it's so good.
Phenomenal. Dan Wyke, I will see you next week. Thank you for listening, guys. We'll be back. I don't know when we'll be back. We'll be back when we have a guest the caliber of Dan. We'll see you then. Thanks, guys. So-